The Tolkien Road, Episode 241, The War of the Ring. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 241. Greta, what's up?
Hey. Not a whole lot. You know, just keeping it real. Jabbing. You know, just being cool, as usual. How about you?
Just keeping it real.
Keeping it real.
It's nice that we don't have to stretch out the banter as long as we used to. Because obviously we don't have anything to talk about.
Obviously not.
Obviously our lives are boring.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe it's just that we see each other all the time. So,
yeah.
You know, everything that needs to be said has already been said.
Are you saying the witty banter is a little forced?
No.
It's like I said before, it's like jazz, you know, it's like improvisational jazz. It's like, you know, what we're doing here, I'm like, deedly deet de deet, and you're like, rid it dit de do.
That's right.
Right? Actually, it's reversed, so.
How is it?
Yeah.
I'm the rid it to do to do?
No, I'm the rid it to do.
Oh, so what am I again?
That's Andy Bernard, so.
Oh, but wait, what was the other one?
Doesn't matter, some nerd.
No. What was the first sound you made?
Deedly deet de deet.
Oh, I'm the deedly deed deed.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's like that Drowning Mona theme song. Do do do
do do do. Oh, popcorn.
Do 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 do. Is that
kind
of like what
everyone in the world knows that is by its proper name, Greta, which is popcorn. The first electronic music hit.
Well, I just think of it when I think of Drowning Mona.
Well,
when I think of Drowning Mona, I think of that song. So they're synonymous. Anyway.
All right.
There we
go. On this episode, we are continuing our journey through the History of Middle Earth series as we survey Volume 8, The War of the Ring, which is the third of four volumes dealing with the textual history of The Lord of the Rings. So how's that sound, Greta?
Okay. Third of four. We're getting closer.
Yeah.
Okay.
We only have, including this, we only have five volumes left in the History of Middle Earth.
So are we more than halfway done?
Yeah, we're more than halfway done. Okay. Yeah. We're volume 8, so we're on volume 8, so we're over halfway done.
See, right? I'm confused. Like, I can't do that. Like, when you say third of four, and then you're like 8 out of 15, I'm like, it's just a little much.
I'm being deliberately obtuse and confusing and ambiguous, just like Christopher Tolkien's writing style.
That's fair.
It's seeping into me, into my consciousness.
I thought you were going to say you're being obscure on purpose because you're trying to lose listeners. And I was like, that doesn't make sense.
No, not trying to lose listeners at all. In fact, before we get started, we want to thank our listeners and especially our patrons. How'd you like that, Sieg?
That was good. Special, that wasn't even planned.
Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lise Yu, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous.
Thanks, guys.
You, too, can become a patron of The Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like audio recordings of my two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture. Check it out now to learn more about all of the exciting perks we offer. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free. Also, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Leaving us a 5-star rating and a review helps get the word out about us. So be like Anime 1984, who recently left a review entitled Fun, a 5-star review, and said, "You guys crack me up, but they are good."
That right, cracks me up,
right,
actually.
Which,
okay.
I think there might be a typo in there because I think it might be like, you guys crack me up, but you are good, but maybe you are good. Because it goes, or I'm just a little confused by it because it seems to switch from second person to third person. But regardless, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for listening.
Yes.
And I'm glad that we crack you up because, you know, that's a little part of what
it's
we do here.
Know.
We try to do.
Yeah, so, it is.
Sometimes
it is.
Inadvertently. Probably more of the time inadvertently. So.
But, you know, even when it happens, we just embrace it.
That's right.
So. Good. Well, that's awesome. I'm glad that people think we're funny.
It's like funny freeform improvisational jazz. Yes.
There we go.
Yeah.
Well, it's just nice to know that you are cracking other people up and not just yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's just nice.
Wait, me?
No. I'm saying I'm glad that other people find us funny, that we just don't find ourselves funny.
Oh, okay.
I know that we do find ourselves funny, but it's nice to know that it's like other people get it too.
It's fun when you crack your own self up. when you're
that
a,
is
you
fun.
Know, when
that
you're,
is
like,
fun
entering.
Too.
But
actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good stuff. Thank you, Anime 1984.
Thank you, indeed, Anime 1984. Great to hear from you, and thank you for your leaving a 5-star review for us and a nice comment. We really appreciate it.
Yes, very much.
And YouTube. Hey, so something a little new for you here. It is time for the all-new weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for all of those watching us on YouTube.
Oh.
Right? New weekly thing. So, you ready for the first weekly Air 5 for our YouTube watchers?
Yes, all right. I actually am.
Here we go. Now's your chance to stop and then go over to YouTube and listen to us or watch us on YouTube if you're listening right now. Now's your chance to go over to YouTube and watch.
Watch
all right,
our
you ready
Air
for
5.
This, Retta?
Let's do it.
So I'm going to count down from 3.
Okay.
All right?
Yep.
3, 2, 1. There you go, right? Hope you did that with us. If you're watching on YouTube, Air 5 just right back. We need all the Air 5s we can get.
Don't we all?
So help us out. Help yourself out. Check us out on YouTube, right? You too can be a part of the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5. Just head on over to YouTube where the episode is posted. And while you're at it, subscribe and click the notify bell for our channel. Also, we'd love to hear what you think of the episode over there, so leave a comment. You can also check out the rest of our video library on YouTube, which is already large and growing weekly.
Mm.
So yeah, YouTube. Oh,
lots of good stuff going on. Yeah.
Right on.
Well done, Joe.
Right
well
on.
Done.
Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then stick around to the end of the episode for correspondence and Tolkien news.
Oh, we're doing Tolkien news at the end now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been for a little while.
Oh,
although there hadn't been much news lately.
I hadn't noticed.
Yeah. There hasn't been much news lately in the world of Tolkiendom.
Is there some today?
Actually, there is something that I found right before this episode that I thought was interesting. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's sip through the main contents.
Let's
we
do
can
that.
Get to the fun stuff. Oops, shoot. Did I say that out loud? Let's do the main content.
Are you ready? It is a little bit of a slog, isn't it, Greta? I mean, trust me.
Not going to lie. I tried to weasel my way out of this episode. I tried.
Yeah. Well, you know, this has been kind of a little bit of a due diligence series. There is good stuff. There is good stuff in here.
There is.
But it's a...
We're having to work for it.
This is not Lord of the Rings, you know, Lord of the Rings itself. This is very academic writing, and as much as I respect and admire Christopher, you know, I've come to realize that his style is very is extremely what I feel like what I would call indirect, right?
Mm-hmm.
it's just very hard sometimes to pin down what he's actually saying.
Yeah.
Frequently it's hard to pin down what he's actually saying. So, but we want to provide you guys with this survey and, you know, and I think it's going all right so far. We also want to help ourselves out by doing this survey and know what's in these books actually. Right. Because I think there's some stuff that we'll really want to take a closer look at eventually. In the not too distant future. So
I agree. Yes.
All right, so The War of the Ring is the 8th volume in the History of Middle-earth series and the 3rd volume in the subset collectively known as The History of the Lord of the Rings. It was published in 1990. The last volume, The Treason of Isengard, left off with the King of the Golden Hall, just as Tolkien was dreaming up Theoden, Edoras, and the rest of the lore of Rohan. The War of the Ring picks up with the destruction of Isengard and travels roughly parallel to The Lord of the Rings all the way to the end of Book 5.
Wait. Book 5
of Lord of the Rings, right? Which would be...
Oh, I forget that there's more than 3.
Yeah, well, there's 3 volumes. It's divided
right,
into 3 volumes. It's one book divided into 3 volumes, and there's like 6 sub-books, right?
That's right, 2 per
now,
volume.
Now, the sub-books don't actually have titles in the final version, right? But originally, Tolkien had proposed titles for the different sub-books, right? For the 6 different sub-books. And we talked about those last week. But here's what Christopher has to say about the title of this one. The title of this book comes from the same source as The Treason of Isengard, a set of 6 titles, one for each book of The Lord of the Rings, suggested by my father in a letter to Rainer Unwin of March 1953, which we read last week on this episode, at least the snippet. The War of the Ring was that proposed for Book 5, and I have adopted it for this book since the history of the writing of Book 5 constitutes nearly half of it. So that's where this title comes from. War of the Ring was supposed to be Book 5. And if, you know, just if in case Book 5 is not, you can't immediately access what that means. Book 5 is basically those are basically like the Minas Tirith chapters, right? So that's like, you know, after Helm's Deep, after the fall of Sauron, and then after Frodo and Sam journey to Cirith Ungol and are attacked by Shelob, and, you know, we have that cliffhanger at the end of The Two Towers. So book five is what is where Return of the King picks up, right? And it basically focuses on Minas Tirith, right? And the siege of Minas Tirith and the Battle of Pelennor Fields and all of those things. So
gotcha.
Yeah.
Good.
So concerning the rest of the book, Christopher says this. While the first part concerns the second half is focused on book five, while the first part concerns the victory of Helm's Deep and the destruction of Isengard. The second part, and this is a good example of Christopher being confusing. The second part, well, I think he was describes the writing of Frodo's journey to Cirith Ungol, and this I have called The Ring Goes East, which was the title proposed by my father for book four. Now, he had just said the second half of this book, the second half is focused on book five. And then he says, while the first part concerns the victory of Helm's Deep and the destruction of Isengard, but then he says the second part describes the writing of Frodo's journey. So it's like immediately, and this is the first paragraph in this book, immediately I'm confused, right? Thankfully, there's the table of contents, right? So you can see in the table of contents, part one is the fall of Sauron, which is roughly book three. Part two is The Ring Goes East, or part one, the fall of Sauron, would be roughly the other part of the rest of book three, because the last volume started book three, right? And then part two is The Ring Goes East, which is book four, and then part three is Minas Tirith, which is roughly equivalent to book five. So anyway, what Christopher meant there is that part three on Minas Tirith basically is one half of this book, right? Of this book, The War of the Ring. And then part one and part two in this book are about the other half, right? In terms of total volume of the book, right? Total quantity of pages, right? So again,
I'm just going to take your word for it.
I'm just like right off the bat, you know, Christopher manages to put something in a way that's like, I'm confused and my head hurts. So,
and I haven't even gotten past the first paragraph.
Yeah. When I get to heaven and I see Christopher, I just want to give him a big hug and be like, dude, I hope you've learned how to write a little more clearly.
But maybe he did it on purpose. Maybe he really only wanted the people,
you know,
like a special group of people to enjoy this.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm going to say that to him and he's going to be like, well, John, in fact, if you look at the logic of what you are saying, then it surmises to me that...
surmises to me.
Just like start throwing in big words and, you know, immediately I'm just lost again.
Yeah. But he'll say it with a British accent, which will make it sound
And then I'll just
like
laugh
amazing.
And give him another big hug. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure if he was reading it in his, you know, in his refined British scholarly accent, you know, it would
make much more sense.
Right.
I really
right.
do believe that. So maybe we need the audiobook.
Well,
the
there is no audiobook.
Record of,
there are no audiobook. You, oh, can you imagine doing this as an audiobook? Like, I don't know if they could pay somebody enough to do this as an audiobook.
Mm.
It'd be so hard.
It would
right?
be a project.
Cause
yeah.
it's like, you almost can't do it as an audiobook.
That's
because
true.
It would be too confusing.
That's true. Even like the few times you've had me read something out loud, I completely
Well,
forget,
just the way it goes, like, it shifts between the voice of Christopher
right.
and the voice of his father, right?
And there's also
so
brackets
frequently.
And there's parentheses, and you're not quite sure, do I read this out loud or not?
Tons of footnotes. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot.
An audiobook was a terrible idea. I'm sorry I even brought it up.
Well, you're fired again.
I'm fired.
So
it's my out. I can leave?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, just
well,
kidding. You're not
moving
fired.
Moving on.
All right. I'd fire myself before I fired you.
Aww.
Leave you to do the show all by yourself.
Thanks.
All right. Yeah, so the table of contents consists of 28 chapters divided into three parts. Those parts are part one, the fall of Sauron, which goes from the destruction of Isengard to the Palantir. Part two, The Ring Goes East, which goes from the taming of Smeagol to Cirith Ungol. Part three, Minas Tirith, which goes from the chapter Minas Tirith to the Black Gate Opens. Okay. There are also 17 illustrations, including sketches of Shelob's lair and early renderings of Minas Tirith. And some of these are pretty cool. I mean, they're not like super detailed, but, you know, in Tolkien's own style and just cause kind of like notes for himself, they're kind of cool to look at, especially the ones of Minas Tirith and Shelob's lair. And then there's another one I'll get to in just a moment.
And that Minas Tirith is the White City, right?
Yes, Minas Tirith is... Okay. Sometimes think just call Gondor what you think of is Gondor, but Gondor is a whole region.
That's where Denethor is everybody. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
So let's look at some of the highlights from the various parts. So the first thing I highlighted was a quote from Christopher at the beginning, the very beginning of the first chapter, which is entitled The Destruction of Isengard. This is what Christopher says. The writing of the story from the King of the Golden Hall to the end of the first book of the Two Towers was an extremely complex process. The Isengard story was not conceived and set down as a series of clearly marked chapters, each one brought to a developed state before the next was embarked on, but evolved as a whole, and disturbances of the structure that entered as it evolved led to dislocations all through the narrative. With my father's method of composition at this time, passages of very rough and piecemeal drafting being built into a completed manuscript that was in turn heavily overhauled, the whole complex advancing and changing at the same time. The textual confusion in this part of The Lord of the Rings is only penetrable with great difficulty, and to set it out as a clear sequence, impossible. So basically, this was all very complex, and I will say, this sounds like a fitting description for the entire history of Middle-earth series, right?
Right?
Yes. It's like trying to, it feels like the whole thing, this is a whole exercise in like trying to unravel a Gordian knot, right? You know what a Gordian knot is, Greta?
Yes, I do know what a Gordian knot is.
Explain.
I know this because our son was studying ancient history this year. So I know it was a knot that was made in... And it was like impossible to untie it.
Right.
And then someone came along and just cut it. Was it Napoleon?
I'm not sure. Let's see. A knot tied by Gordius, king of Phrygia.
Oh, Alexander the Great.
Okay, is Alexander.
Alexander the Great and Napoleon mixed up all the time.
Well, they lived a long time apart and in vastly different countries.
I know, but they kind of remind me of each other.
I mean, they both conquered large, like humongous regions of land. So
I remember thinking that was pretty, pretty obnoxious of Alexander the Great to just come with his sword and cut it. Like, that was totally the easy way out. It just shows you that he thought a lot of himself, just like Napoleon.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's why I get them mixed up.
Well,
they're like historical figures that thought a lot of themselves.
Okay. Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
Good.
As I was saying, it does feel like it's a very, the whole thing is just super complex. As I've said before, as I'm doing research for these episodes, like it's hard mental work. It's very hard mental work. And I can only imagine, it's a good thing, you know, Christopher probably, was making a decent living doing this because it would have been hard work. He never would have been able to get through it if he had not been making a, decent living or had the promise of selling many more books under his father's name. So, all right. So, it sounds to me from this, like Tolkien was getting into the zone as it were, when he got to this point, it was all starting to come to him though, not in an entirely orderly fashion. Hmm. Remember, Tolkien seems to have been writing in the sense of discovering things. And so he was like always jotting down notes as he like envisioned different scenes. I don't think he wasn't writing in necessarily an entirely chronological order, but things will pop up, like Treebeard pops up super early, and then he doesn't actually, way earlier than he actually comes in the chronology of writing the story. And at first, Tolkien's not exactly sure what to make of him. He just pops up out of nowhere. And if you read Mythopoeia and like, especially Mythopoeia, like you can kind of get a sense of where of Tolkien's creative process from that. Cause he really had this kind of belief of inspiration coming from outside, like the best inspiration coming from outside in a very mysterious and even spiritual fashion. So, he was frequently getting bogged down in the details as well. We can see why the writing of Lord of the Rings took so long. It was complex on so many fronts, but of course, that's one of the things that we love about it. When you go back and you find it's interesting to read, like to read some of the stuff in here, and it's a mess in a lot of ways. But then you go and read the finished product and it's like, it's like, wow, like even this doesn't completely explain how we got from here to here. Maybe something is owed to just the process of editing and, mm-hmm. and other documents that we may not have, mm-hmm. but, you know, but it's almost like this is trying to kind of explain some of the magic behind the process of writing this book, mm-hmm. but there was more magic that we probably will never see, right? That got it from here to what we have in the final book.
It's still a far leap from this.
I mean, there's a lot you recognize, like you recognize all like a lot of the things in here from the actual books, but they're not in finished form, right? They're rough. Rough. That's a good word. Rough.
It's a good
all right.
Rough. Yeah.
That's for all you dog lovers out there. Mm-hmm. All right. Concerning Helm's Deep, Christopher says, a first draft of this story, abandoned after it had proceeded for some distance, differs so essentially from its form in The Two Towers that I give it here in full. This text bears the chapter number 28 without title. So I bring this up to say that for those of you who are big Helm's Deep fans, and I mean, I am too, this might be pretty interesting for you because, you know, and I have not read it in detail. I did spend a little time with it trying to pull some nuggets that would seem interesting, but I couldn't really find any in the limited amount of preparation time I had. So I'm going to leave this one to you guys and just say, if y'all find cool stuff in this first draft of the story, which apparently differs and essentially from the final version, then, you know, call it out, let us know, and send us a note for a future episode. For reading it on, you know, for correspondence on a future episode. At a glance, there seems to be a lot of interesting material in The Road to Isengard, but I am fascinated by the developing sketches of Orthanc provided therein, especially the sketch labeled Orthanc 2, 3, and 4.
Like illustrations.
Yeah, so I'm going to show this to you, but basically, so in The Road to Isengard is the next chapter in the book, but basically, let me say this. One frustration I have is that the version of the text I used for The Treason of Isengard is missing the frontispiece that apparently should be there. Because, and do you know what a frontispiece is? Mm-hmm. So a frontispiece is like, it's like inside the cover. It's like an illustration inside the cover. Mm. You see this in some books, right? It's like a black and white illustration inside the cover that depicts some scene from the story, right?
Okay.
And apparently he refers to it in this chapter, he says the description, this description fits the picture captioned Orthanc 1 that was reproduced as frontispiece to Volume 7, The Treason of Isengard, except in one respect. So he's referring to this frontispiece, but it's not in my version of The Treason of Isengard. So I have no way of comparing it to what he says here. But the pictures he has of Orthanc in this chapter, we see how Orthanc was developing in his mind, and the main one in this image of three, I'll say, like, it looks more ominous than the final version of Orthanc, in my opinion. I think
Do we have a final version?
Well, yeah, like, you can kind of, the one that's in the film is pretty close to what the final imagining of it would have been, right?
As described in The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but in the one one you see there is not on a raised mound like this. Or if it is raised, it's not perceptible. But in here, it's like this steep raised mound that the tower rises up off of. And to me,
the tower's very pointy.
And the tower's very pointy. But to me, that looks even more ominous, right? Than, like, you know, than being on flat ground, because it's like having to climb some mound just to get to the entrance of this place, you know, makes it look just scarier, in my opinion.
And much more easy to defend.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be, because if you're on high ground, you have the upper hand.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, all right. The next highlight is the matter of Sam's name. So I found this really interesting.
So he wasn't always Sam, huh?
Well, let's listen up to what we got here.
Okay.
A curious vestige is seen in the name Goodchild penciled above Gamgee in Sam's remark, "It's beyond any Gamgee to guess what he'll do next." In his letter to me, Christopher is speaking here, in his father's letter to him of 31st May 1944, my father said, "Sam, by the way, is an abbreviation not of Samuel, but of Samwise, the Old English for half-wit, as is his father's name, the gaffer, Ham, for Old English, ham-fast, or stay-at-home. Hobbits of that class have very Saxon names as a rule, and I am not really satisfied with the surname Gamgee and should change it to Goodchild if I thought you would let me. Christopher says, I replied that I would never wish to see Gamgee changed to Goodchild, and urged, entirely missing the point, that the name Gamgee was for me the essential expression of the Hobbit peasantry in their slightly comical aspect, deeply important to the whole work. I mentioned this to explain my father's subsequent remarks on the subject. And then he quotes again from the same letter, from a different letter, sorry. As to Sam Gamgee, I quite agree with what you say, and I wouldn't dream of altering his name without your approval. But the object of the alteration was precisely to bring out the comicness, peasantry, and if you will, the Englishry of this jewel among the hobbits. Had I thought it out at the beginning, I should have given all the hobbits very English names to match the Shire. I doubt if it's English, i.e. the name Gamgee. However, I dare say all your imagination of the characters now bound up with the name. And so Sam Gamgee remained. But for a little while there, we almost had Samwise Goodchild, right? So,
well, that's one point for Christopher.
Yeah.
He stuck up for Gamgee.
Stuck up for Gamgee?
Which just sounds better, too.
Yeah.
Samwise Goodchild is too much of a mouthful, I think.
Yeah, something about Goodchild just doesn't match with Sam's personality in my mind.
I agree.
That sounds too... I can't one-up Tolkien, obviously, on his knowledge of Old English and, like, names and the, you know, history of names and that kind of thing. But, Goodchild sounds not like a peasant name to me.
No, it sounds a little bit more, not pretentious, but... It sounds like someone from a well-to-do family.
It sounds like Goody Two Shoes, you know.
There you go. That's what I was thinking. So maybe pretentious is the right word. I don't know.
Yeah,
but it also just sounds almost too sweet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, not that Sam's not sweet, but he's also very tough and brave and everything. It's too soft.
That's another good point. It's too soft of a name for him. Gamgee, you know, does sound a little. Even though I think it means like wool or whatever, it sounds a little. Is it tobacco? Now I gotta look up what Gamgee means again, even though I've seen it before. Gamgee does sound not tough exactly, but what is a Gamgee? A layer of cotton wool. Yeah, I was right. Okay, mm-hmm. so just a little more earthy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like
it's got some texture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For real.
Mm-hmm. It's the difference between, cashmere and wool. Like, Goodchild is more like cashmere.
Yeah.
Too soft. I mean, I like a cashmere sweater, but anyway. A name, it's too soft.
Right. Right on. All right. Next up is a description of Shelob. Yeah, ooh. Description of Shelob. So this is really interesting, y'all. All right, a couple of things to say about Shelob and the emergence of Shelob in the story. So the first thing is the description. Wait, did I mark it right?
It doesn't appear so.
Yeah, I may not have. What did I... Oh, man, did I screw that up? Where is it? Maybe it's 292? Hopefully it's 292. Nope.
No.
Okay, well... This is going to be really cool, so I'm going to have to find this for you guys. All right, that's Cirith Ungol. Okay, here we go. 196. 196A. That's what it was.
Come on, Johnny.
All
right. 2-6. Don't even look alike.
All right. As he stood up again, he saw issuing out of a crevice at the left the most monstrous and loathly form that he had ever beheld, beyond his imagination. Spider-like it was in shape, but huge as a wild beast and more terrible because of the malice and evil purpose in its eyes. These were many, clustered in its small head, and each of them held a baleful light. On great bent legs it walked, the hairs of them stuck out like steel spines, and at each end there was a claw. The round, swollen body behind its narrow neck was dark-blotched with paler, livid marks, but underneath its belly was pale and faintly luminous as its eyes. It stank. It moved with a sudden, horrible speed, running on its arms and springing. Sam saw at once that he was hunting his master, now a little ahead in the gloom and apparently unaware of his peril. He whipped out his sword and yelled, "Look out, Mr. Frodo, look out! I'm..." But he did not finish. A long, clammy hand went over his mouth, and another caught his neck, while something wrapped itself about his legs. Taken off his guard, he fell backwards in the arms of his attacker.
Wait, so Sam's the one that gets attacked?
Well, Sam gets attacked by Gollum, right?
Oh, that's Gollum, yeah. Yes. Okay.
But going on, that's just right. A little bit more, yeah. Right? Got you, hissed Solomon in his ear. At last, my precious one, we've got him, yes, the nasty hobbit. We takes this one. She'll get the other. Oh, yes. Ungoliant will get him, not Smeagol. He won't hurt Master, not at all. He promised, but he's got you, you nasty, dirty little thing.
Ooh.
So, here's the thing. Tolkien refers to what we know as Shelob as Ungoliant for a good part of the writing in The War of the Ring. So, what's really curious to me is I could not find Christopher making a bigger deal out of this than you would expect, right? You would expect him to make kind of a big deal about, like, when did Ungoliant, was he thinking about making this Ungoliant in the first place, and then he became Shelob? Was it indeed originally conceived as Ungoliant? And to be honest, I have a hard time discerning where Shelob ceases to be Ungoliant within this story. And I think somewhat it's due to the fact that both names are just just words in different languages for spider, right? Mm. I think Shelob may be, let me see if I can find the reference. I think Shelob may in fact be Old English for, I think it may be Old English for spider. And then Ungoliant, I think, is like Quenya or Sindarin for spider, right?
So do you think they might be one and the same?
Well, you know, I can't find anything that 100% says to me that they aren't, right? Now, here's what I'll say. So help me out with this, people. Like, correspond with me and set me straight on this, because I just feel like there's something there, like I've just forgotten the reference that says that Shelob is actually the descendant of Ungoliant. And maybe I just need to look in the Lord of the Rings. It's the final version to say that she's the descendant of Ungoliant. But nevertheless, it's very interesting. Now, I will read this snippet from letter 180. And I think this, you know, this starts to clear up the matter a little bit. And it's probably going to be a reference from Lord of the Rings, and I'm just not thinking of it or couldn't find it as I was preparing for this episode. So just help me out on that. But anyway, I found it interesting. It's Ungoliant. Here's what this letter has to say about this. Oh, wait, page 180. I always get tripped up on the letter numbers.
Mm, easy to do.
Yeah. All right. The Balrog is a survivor from the Silmarillion and the legends of the First Age. So is Shelob. The Balrogs, of whom the whips were the chief weapons, all right, so get that, right? The Balrog is a survivor from the Silmarillion and the legends of the First Age. So is Shelob. What? Mm-hmm. First Age? Shelob? Okay, let's going on, right? The Balrogs, of whom the whips were the chief weapons, were primeval spirits of destroying fire, chief servants of the primeval dark power of the First Age. They were supposed to have been all destroyed in the overthrow of Thangorodrim, his fortress in the north. But it is here found, there is usually a hangover, especially of evil from one age to another, that one had escaped and taken refuge under the mountains of Hithaeglen, the Misty Mountains. It is observable that only the elf knows what the thing is, and doubtless Gandalf. So Shelob, English representing, Old English representing Shelob, female spider, is a translation of Elvish Ungol, spider. She is represented in Volume 2, page 332, as descendant of the giant spiders of the glens of Nandungorthin, which came into the legends of the First Age, especially into the chief of them, the tale of Beren and Lúthien. This is constantly referred to, since, as Sam points out, the history is in a sense only a further continuation of it. Both Elrond and his daughter Arwen Undomiel, who resembles Lúthien closely in looks and fate, are descendants of Beren and Lúthien. And so at very many more removes is Aragorn. The giant spiders were themselves only the offspring of Ungoliant, the primeval devourer of light, that in spider form assisted the dark power, but ultimately quarreled with him. There is thus no alliance between Shelob and Sauron, the dark power's deputy, only a common hatred. Galadriel is as old or older than Shelob. She is the last remaining of the great among the High Elves, and awoke in Eldamar beyond the sea, long before Ungoliant came to Middle-earth and produced her broods there. So that would seem to indicate, so there, first of all, you have in volume 2, page 332, that Shelob is descended from the giant spiders of the glens of Nundungorthen, and then that those spiders are descendant or the offspring of Ungoliant, right? So it would seem here that that negates the possibility that Shelob is the same as Ungoliant,
right? Yeah,
but still, it's like, I don't know. This is a weird kind of textual anomaly that I'm finding here, right? Mm-hmm. And it's even within the letter, you know, he says that Shelob is a holdover from the first age.
Mm-hmm.
So, and maybe he just means that coming from the stories of like having the giant spiders,
like descended
right?
From, yeah.
But I found this very interesting, especially because he refers to Shelob as Ungoliant for so long in this early version of the Lord of the Rings. So
yeah, that is really interesting.
Yeah.
Huh, it's a bit of a mind bender, brain teaser.
Yeah. For real. So if you got any thoughts on that, want to share any thoughts on that, I'd love to hear the thoughts from any of our listeners. So, you know, let me know. So, all right. And the last thing I wanted to share, the last highlight that I found was what I'm calling Nice Guy Denethor. So surprisingly, you know, Denethor is probably one of the least liked characters in the entire story, right? He's just, you know, grouchy and, you know, he's really mean to Faramir, like horribly mean to Faramir, his surviving son. And that's just not going to win you any fans. But I found this, which makes him out to be not such a bad guy, maybe after all. His sudden softening. So this is Christopher narrating the opening to a passage I'm about to read from the original version of the Siege of Gondor. Christopher says, his sudden softening in response to Faramir's question, do you wish then that our places had been exchanged, remains? And then this is the quote, yes, I wish that indeed, said Denethor, or no. And then he shook his head, and rising swiftly, he laid his hand upon his son's bowed head. Do not judge me harshly, my son, he said quietly, or believe me more harsh than I am. I knew your brother well also. Love is not blind. I could wish that Boromir had been at Hinnith Anun when this thing came there, only if I were sure of one thing. Sure of what, my father? That he was as strong in heart and selfless as you, my son. That taking this thing he would have brought it here and surrendered it, and not fallen swiftly under its thraldom. For Faramir, and you too, Mithrandir, amid all your wide webs and policies, there is a third way. That is neither the folly of wizards nor the lust of warriors. So, wow, Denethor actually being kind of likable there, right? You know, he starts to say some nasty things, but then he takes it back and he basically says, like, you're good. Like, I admire you, Faramir. He says you're strong of heart and selfless, right? And Christopher clarifies. He goes on to say, it is certain that there was no element of embittered banter in these words, that he was as strong in heart and selfless as you, my son. Denethor was coldly watchful, as always, of those he spoke to, but he expressed the true bearing of his mind. His gentler good night to Faramir, with the suggestion of a comforting word, remains. And in this brief passage it can be seen how Denethor's harshness towards Faramir was enforced in later revision by the slightest of touches, as in the movement from "You are weary, my son," to "You are weary, I see." Again, in the debate on the following day, it is still Faramir who argues that an attempt must be made to hold the outer defenses at the line of the Anduin. But so far does new writing go towards the actual words of Return of the King that when my father came to revise the passage, he had little more to do than to give the speeches to different speakers. In this version, the speech made by Prince Imrahil, warning of another host that may come from Mordor, is given to Gandalf, and it is Faramir who is adamant and concludes the debate with words that afterwards became his father's. Much must be risked in war, said Faramir, but I will not yield the river and the fields of Pelennor unfought, unless my father commands me beyond denial. I do not, said Denethor. Farewell, and may your judgment prove just, at least so much that I may see you again. Farewell.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Denethor wasn't such a bad guy at first.
Initially, no. I wonder why Tolkien decided to revise him so harshly, I guess.
Yeah, well, maybe the answer is in that chapter. So again, invite people to you know, go deeper, or if you already know, you know, what Tolkien's reasoning on that was, would love to hear from you. But that was another big, you know, big mystery that you know, that I'd uncovered in researching this one. So anyway, so Greta, that's our survey of the War of the Ring. As always, that is just an overview with a few highlights. To be sure, there are over 400 pages of material to delve into here. So if that whets your appetite for more, pick up a copy, get reading, and let us know what other precious gems you find.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to news. So the news bit I have is, I just saw this like literally just a little bit ago as I was preparing for this, but apparently on May 11th, which was yesterday as we record, which is Wednesday, it was Tuesday, the 2021 Tolkien lecture was given by Guy Gavriel Kay, right? And Guy Gavriel Kay was the individual who helped Christopher Tolkien compile the Silmarillion. Right. And put together the Silmarillion in its final published form.
Hmm.
We've spoken about him a few times on the podcast. And he's still a, he's written tons of his own fantasy. But I have not had a chance to listen to this lecture at all, but I just found it fascinating. This is for Pembroke College of Oxford. But I found it fascinating that he was delivering the Tolkien lecture in 2021, right? Because from my experience, he's been very reticent to say anything about his experience with the Silmarillion. I don't know if he speaks of it in any way. I assume if he did, then there would be lots of big news about it, but I'm going to listen to this thing and report back to you all. I'm trying to remember with Pembroke if it's if that's a place where, first of all, to any of our British listeners, i.e. David Bates or anybody else, am I saying Pembroke incorrectly? Like I would say Magdalen College, right? Magdalen. Let me know if I'm saying Pembroke incorrectly. But let's see. Why does Pembroke have a Tolkien lecture? Oh, yeah. Okay. So Tolkien was professor of Anglo-Saxon at Pembroke. I just always get mixed up, you know. I'm like Oxford, right?
And but all it's the different, at like, Oxford.
It
right?
is at Oxford, and then I'm yeah. like, I get, but there's all these like colleges within the Oxford
within,
University
yes.
system.
Okay,
you know?
Okay.
So me being a Yank, I get mixed up by all of
That's
that.
That's fair. Well, it looked like when you Googled it, there's also a Pembroke in Cambridge.
Yes, I did see that, but I didn't look it
so
up.
So that's.
But this is Oxford,
right? Which is where Tolkien was a professor. Right. That makes sense. Okay.
So anyway, I'm going to link to this in the show notes. But there's a YouTube video of the Guy Gavriel Kay 2021 Tolkien lecture. The title of it is Just Enough Light, Some Thoughts on Fantasy and Literature. So I'm interested to watch it. We'll see if he says anything about his time with Tolkien, but, you know, experienced writer of fantasy in his own right. So surely time well spent for those who are admirers of Tolkien.
So definitely
check that out, and while you're on YouTube, make sure and check out the Tolkien Road as well, and make sure and subscribe if you're not already. All right, another virtue of having watched this episode on YouTube, right?
Oh, you're just already there. You can get
you're
to the lecture
there, right?
quicker. Yeah, it's true.
All right, well, send us tips on news, by the way, if you see anything come across the interwebs that you find interesting that we haven't already covered. Let us know.
Yes.
All right. A little bit of correspondence for this week. First off, we have a couple of shorter notes from Marilyn the Librarian.
Hmm.
The first is from May 7th. And she says, "Hello, Carswells. I'm probably too late for the recording deadline for the next episode, but I'll send this anyway since it's on my mind. The name Bingo came from the children's large family of koala teddy bears, according to Carpenter's biography. I think they were mostly Priscilla's, actually, but I can't recall where that notion came from. The dwarf names weren't invented by Tolkien at all. They came from the Norse Eddas, the sources of mythic poetry and such. And yes, I'm glad that Trotter became Strider, especially because Trotters is a British name for pig's feet, which were a popular dish in England at one time."
That's funny.
Isn't that one of the things that you can get in that game, Pig
yep,
Out?
It is.
You can get a Trotter.
Not Pig Out. It's a toss the pigs. It's not Pig Out. It's, what is it? Pass the Pigs.
Pass the Pigs.
Pass the Pigs.
I thought it was, it used to be called Pig. When I played it when I was a little kid, it was called Pig, I think.
It's, well, I've only known it as Pass the Pigs. Pass the Pigs. But yeah, a Trotter is one of the ones you can get. And I think it might be when you land it on all, when it lands on all fours.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think that might be it. Yeah. Which is a really fun game.
It is a really fun game. We haven't played that in a while.
No, we haven't. We need to play that.
The reason why Tolkien didn't think it should be Bilbo who had the next adventure in The New Hobbit was because Tolkien had already written of Bilbo, and he lived very happily to the end of his days, which were very long. He simply had a hard time imagining how that ending can lead to an altogether new story. That was why he kept looking for other hobbits to have the adventure of The New Hobbit. Again, I'm glad he settled on a nephew named Frodo and not a son or a hobbit named Bingo. All the best, Marilyn.
Oh, good. Good, yeah. good insights.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then here's her other note. This is entitled Balrogs, etc. As always, fun to hear you take on Lord of the Rings in progress, so to speak. Greta commented on the red tongue of the Balrog. In many medieval depictions, demons were given red tongues, and Tolkien picks up on that a couple of times, mm-hmm. including here, though he dropped it in the final version, I believe, and also for one of the armies of Sauron, not orcs, though. Balrogs occurred several times in the Silmarillion, i.e. before Tolkien was writing his first drafts of Lord of the Rings, including at their rescue of Morgoth from Ungoliant and in several key battles. Most notable, though, was the Battle of the Balrog with Glorfindel at the fall and sacking of Gondolin. Glorfindel kills that Balrog, but also dies himself and returns to Mondos. After a short time, he goes back to Valinor, but then returns to Middle-earth, where we eventually see him confront the riders at the fords of Bruinen, thus allowing Frodo to escape. Mm. You mentioned the word Hnau in Tolkien's notes about Treebeard. This was a C.S. Lewis word from his space trilogy. He created it to describe sentient beings who were sentient regardless of their shape, animal, or in this case, tree. Yeah, I thought I remembered that from the space trilogy, from having read that. It's been a while, but from having read that. And as for the title, The Notion Club Papers, you might ponder the fact that another word for notion is inkling.
Oh.
Nice.
Leave it to Marilyn.
Why didn't they just call them the Inkling Club Paper? Because that would have been like, everybody would be like, oh, I got to read those, right?
Maybe that's why. Maybe they wanted to be a little, you know, underground, like a little on the down low.
All too clever for their own good.
So clever. Yeah. So clever. Yeah. Man, the depth of Marilyn's knowledge is, you know, it's amazing to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Every time we read something from her, it's good stuff.
Yep, I love getting notes from Marilyn. So
yes, as do I.
Thank you so much, Marilyn.
Yes, thank you.
We also have a note from Paul M. And Paul's note is very short. Paul says, "Did Greta reread A Calibeth?
Fudge.
She said she was going to see if she likes it better than the first time, but I don't think it was mentioned in the last podcast episode. No pressure. Just want to make sure I didn't miss her newest review."
Oops.
So
that gives you an idea of my the extent of my memory these days.
Maybe we need to schedule that in for Greta's reread of A Calibeth and let her like lead the episode. Maybe that needs to be a special episode at some point.
I really appreciate Paul reminding me because I totally forgot that I was going to do that.
Paul, I'm going to put that on our list of future episodes so we can get Greta to do that. So
that's what it's going to take.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Yes. Nice hearing from you. And then our last is a comment on our most recent, on episode 239, on YouTube. So this is from Bree S. Bree says, theory, that first beginning line when M- might have been when Mr. Bilbo Baggins, perhaps Tolkien was interrupted as you suggested and on returning decided that was not the best way to reintroduce Bilbo. I think that's entirely possible. And
yeah, I didn't think about a surname.
I wish it was something much more like, you know, crazy.
More likely.
There's a specific
possible. Gosh,
I can't think of this. I see this all. People say this all the time. It's the most likely, the easiest explanation for it, right?
Is that what you were trying to find?
It is, oh my gosh.
Obvious?
I am not going to stop on this until I figure out what that word is.
I don't know what you're trying to think of.
The most... Occam's Razor. Occam's Razor, right?
I've never even heard of that.
You never heard of Occam's Razor?
No.
Yeah, Occam's Razor. The principle of parsimony or law of parsimony Basically, it's a problem-solving principle that entities should not be multiplied without necessity, or more simply, the simplest explanation is usually the best one.
Oh, I didn't know that had a term like that.
Yeah.
So Occam was a person?
Occam, yeah. He was a philosopher from the 13th and 14th centuries.
Okay.
Basically, early 14th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yes, that's that. I suppose that would be the Occam's razor
yes.
explanation there, Bree.
Agreed.
So,
agreed, yeah.
And she goes on to say, also, I'm a little disappointed that you only mentioned that Trotter was the original name for Strider. There's a bunch more interesting facts about him and the attempts at figuring him out, and at one point, Strider probably would not have been a good name. I suppose people will just have to read the book to find out. Yeah, I mean, that's the key. Look, I hate to disappoint. And I honestly, as I go through this series, I'm disappointed with myself in every episode of this one, right? Because there's just so much. And I wish I could devote all my, sufficient time to preparing for each one of these, but I'm a newbie to them. And so that's why I've said at the outset that this is a survey and I'm pretty new. I've read parts of the history of Middle Earth, but I'm pretty new to them overall. And, it's enough of a task just to explain, some of the basics and then the highlights, but I definitely plan to do an episode that focuses on Aragorn or maybe even two or three episodes that focus on Aragorn in the future. And so, I think one of the topics we'll try to cover with any character we do a deep dive on is where did that character come from?
Mm-hmm. Right? Their development.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will say one thing that I'm almost 100% certain of is that, if I recall correctly, Trotter was originally a hobbit, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
He was just like an adventurous hobbit, like a more adventurous hobbit. So, yeah. Which maybe that's what she was referring to. Trotter being a better... that he would have been trotting rather than striding, right? Because he's a hobbit and he has short legs.
He has hobbit feet too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, but Bree, feel free to drop some knowledge bombs on us as well. And we always love hearing from other people. And don't claim to have a corner on Tolkien knowledge here, so at all. All right. Well, thanks, Bree.
Yes.
Nice hearing from you.
Yeah,
please do keep in touch. All right. Well, that is all for our correspondence this week. We'd love to hear from each and every one of you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc. Instagram, of course. I got to add Instagram to that list. I'm starting to get more consistent about posting over there. So on our next episode, we will continue our survey of the history of Middle-earth with Volume 9, Sauron Defeated, where we will explore the final volume in the development of The Lord of the Rings. And then we only have 3 more volumes of the History of Middle-earth after that, Greta.
That's right. Okay.
So.
Okay. We're making good progress.
That's right. That's all for this episode. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following. Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
Lise Yu.
Andrew T.
John R.
Ms. Anonymous.
Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pints with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Johanna T.
Mike M.
Duranayer.
Robert H.
Paul D.
Jacob S.
And Julia.
As well as all those celebrating their patron anniversary in May, Ms. Anonymous.
Joshua Y.
Donna S.
Rebecca R.
James R.
Ty M.
Thank you all so much.
Yes, thank you guys.
And thanks to all of our listeners. We will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.